Okay. Hi, everyone. Welcome to Office Hours. I hope you all are having a great holiday season and end to 2020, which has been a tough year for many of us. Here are the questions today. We just have three, but they're great questions. The first one is about low bicarbonate and elevated chloride in the blood, which would suggest to me something called hyperchloremic acidosis, which is usually due to the loss of bicarbonate. And can have gastrointestinal, renal, or other causes. Bicarbonate supplementation is often used in clinical settings to correct this kind of acidosis. However, I do think that something it's something to be explored with the healthcare provider. Don't just supplement with bicarbonate by yourself. Although it could be totally fine. It is also possible that acidosis isn't at play, so I wouldn't go making assumptions just based off of one blood chemistry report. Maybe look at past data, look at running another one before you go making or jumping to conclusions. Next question is about optimal health outcome-based reference range for fasting insulin. Now, there is no great all-cause mortality-based reference range for fasting insulin. However, other literature from the Katavans, other literature looking at long-term metabolic health outcomes suggests that somewhere between 2 and 6 is probably optimal. And then last question is about houseplants. So houseplants probably don't clean the air as well as we originally thought based off of the NASA study. At least in normal living environments. The original study was conducted in very small sealed containers, which doesn't necessarily extrapolate to a large open room where you're letting air in and out. But we do have studies showing that houseplants can be stress relieving. So I wouldn't necessarily go throwing out all of your houseplants just yet, even if they don't clean the air like we originally thought that they did. Okay, so first question. If bicarbonate marker is low and chloride is high, would this be an acidic condition? And what would help to correct this condition? Would taking baking soda correct the situation? So yes, to me, this sounds like hyperchloremic acidosis, which occurs when there is an excessive amount of bicarbonate lost. So it's not due to an excess amount of acid production or acid retention, which can occur with other kinds of metabolic acidosis conditions. So the causes of hyperchloremic acidosis can be gastrointestinal, such as with severe prolonged diarrhea. They can also be, and also chronic laxative use. The cause can be renal, such as with proximal or distal tubular acidosis, and also long-term use of carbonic anhydrase inhibitors, which are typically used to treat glaucoma and sometimes also seizures. Or it can have other exogenous causes such as ingestion of certain acids like HCl or ammonium chloride. Now, GI loss of bicarbonate can also be due to certain supplements and medications, including magnesium sulfate, calcium chloride, and also cholestyramine, which sometimes we use in something like a heavy metal detoxification or a mold detoxification protocol, although it was originally, I believe, used as a cholesterol-lowering drug. But anyway, heavy metals are also known to cause proximal renal tubular acidosis, that's a mouthful, which could end up as looking like hyperchloremic acidosis on a blood chemistry. And NSAIDs are also associated with distal renal tubular acidosis. And there are some other causes for loss of GI bicarbonate and renal tubular acidosis, but those are probably the most common that people listening would potentially think about. Symptoms of hyperchloremic acidosis can include headache, fatigue, nausea, vomiting, and symptoms can become more severe the more severe the acidosis is. You may also see a direct decrease in respiratory rate as the body tries to compensate for the bicarbonate loss. Now, I would consider calculating the anion gap here in blood. So Chris and Tommy did a podcast a couple of years ago, which we'll link to in the show notes about the anion gap. Basically, what it is it's the sum of the sodium and the potassium in the blood minus the sum of the chloride and the CO2. And some calculations leave out the potassium, so that's something to consider. But for hyperchloremic acidosis or the elevated chloride and the low bicarbonate in the blood, calculating the urinary ion gap is also recommended as well. So that would be the sum of the potassium and chloride in the urine minus the, the sum of the potassium and sodium in the urine minus the chloride in the urine. And the urinary ion gap provides an estimate of the excretion of urinary ammonium, which can kind of give you an idea about where the hyperchloremic acidosis is coming from. So a negative urinary anion gap, typically between negative 20 and negative 50, is indicative of an increase in ammonium excretion and is often seen with metabolic acidosis that from causes outside of the kidney, such as diarrhea. And a positive urinary anion gap, so between like 20 and 90 typically, is indicative of a low or normal ammonium excretion and often occurs with kidney pathologies. So again, before getting hung up on metabolic acidosis, I would first look at how high and low the chloride and CO2 are respectively, and also try to get a urinary analysis or urinalysis to measure the urinary ion gap, anion gap, or at least calculate it in blood. Now, as for whether or not baking soda would also potentially correct this pathology, in theory, yes. And actually, baking soda is often, or sodium bicarbonate, I should say, is often supplemented into IV saline solutions for hyperchloremic acidosis treatment when it's tested and monitored in an acute care clinical setting. But again, like I mentioned in the beginning, this is done in the context of careful monitoring of a healthcare provider if it's true acidosis. So, disclaimer, don't try this at home unless, you're quite confident that you're healthy and that it will work. But I would also add to that trying to identify the cause of the acidosis is definitely important for long-term health outcomes. And I'd also consider how severe the acidosis is and look at past blood data if you have it, especially if you're asymptomatic, you don't have fatigue, nausea, vomiting, headaches, those kind of things. I would consider running another blood chemistry again to see if you get that same pattern of low bicarbonate and elevated chloride, and make sure to run your analysis along with it so that you can calculate that urinary anion gap using the urinary electrolytes. And even if it looks like acidosis on one blood chemistry, there's a potential that it's not. So that's just something else to keep in mind. Okay, question two. What is the optimal health outcome-based reference range for fasting insulin? And this is a forum post that we'll link to as well. So first of all, and on the forum, there was talk about C-peptide being a better marker of insulin than insulin itself. And I do agree with that because of the fact that C-peptide has a longer half-life in the blood. Now, as for an optimal range for fasting insulin, if we're sticking to our standards of using all-cause mortality data, which we like to do, this right here is probably the best analysis that we have. Fasting insulin, insulin resistance, and risk of cardiovascular or all-cause mortality in non-diabetic adults, a meta-analysis that came out in 2017. And the pooled relative risk of all-cause mortality when it came to fasting insulin was 1.13, which is not particularly high. And the authors actually concluded that while HOMA-IR, which is a measure of insulin resistance, was associated with a greater risk of all-cause mortality in adults without diabetes, fasting insulin was actually not. And that was based off of three studies. And if we dig deeper into the studies that they looked at, one of the studies had their fasting insulin group, here it is right here. Their low group for fasting insulin was less than or equal to 6.15, which is far too high for my liking. And as we'll discover in a little bit here, that actually might be the very top of where you should be. And then their multivariate adjusted hazard ratio seemed to significantly increase when you got past 8.35. So that was kind of their, right here, their top of the range where you should be. I'm a little bit skeptical about this data because their fasting plasma glucose hazard ratios and their respective optimal reference ranges from that data don't necessarily line up with previous data that we have about all-cause mortality risk in fasting glucose. That doesn't mean that one study is right, one study is wrong, but just a little bit skeptical about their population that they used here. Then the next study, right here, we have from that meta-analysis found that fasting hyperinsulinemia was a predictor of all-cause mortality in non-diabetic men. However, they said that the two-hour post-glucose hyperinsulinemia levels were a stronger predictor of mortality than just the fasting insulin, which makes sense based on what we know from like the Kraft insulin assay. Now, they give the relative ratios for the 10th decile of men, which have fasting insulin of between 21 and 140. And that's right here. So that's quite high, you know, fasting insulins of 21 to 140, which is quite ridiculous and tells us nothing about those with fasting insulins levels of less than 21. And you can see here in figure one that really they found that in these men, the 10th decile, which was again that 21 to 140, that's when you really saw the large increase of deaths per year or events per year. Let's see. So, and then in table two, you can see that the hazard ratios, let me see, table one, table two. Is this what I want? Maybe it's not table two. Hold on a second. Here we go. Table three, sorry. You can see in table three that the hazard ratios increase a bit with the first two models, but then when you get to the more adjusted models, so these are the models down here, this A, B, C. When you get to the more adjusted models, the hazard ratios actually kind of largely dropped to being negligible. So this study showed that only compared with the lowest insulin quartile, the highest quartile was associated with a significant increase in all-cause mortality. And again, that highest quartile was way too high. So to summarize the based off of these studies, and there is one more here which we'll link to. Right here, insulin resistance, cystatin C, and mortality among older adults. So we'll link to those three studies in the show notes. But basically, I don't think that we can concretely come up with a good fasting optimal insulin level, unfortunately. I've definitely heard that optimal is less than 5 from many people out in the kind of functional medicine realm. However, the all-cause mortality literature doesn't support that range. But we can't necessarily have all-cause mortality data for every single marker. And I think actually, now that I'm thinking about it, I might have misspoke. I think that the table two that I was trying to find was actually in this study here. So let me just make sure that that's correct. Yes. Okay. So that's this third study that I was trying to find, table two. You can see that the hazard ratios as the models change largely drop to being negligible. And here's their fasting insulin levels right here. And their top of the insulin range for this one was less than 10. So again, just like that less than 6, it doesn't really tell us about anyone who's less than 10 or less than 6, which is unfortunate. It doesn't kind of pick apart that data. So now on to the more interesting studies. There is some data, for example, in this study right here. Is this the right one? No, this is actually, yes, this one. Elevated and fasting insulin predicts the future incidence of metabolic syndrome, a 5-year follow-up study. Now in this study, their data suggested that fasting insulin of greater than 6 increased, significantly increased the risk of developing metabolic syndrome in the future. Although some, numbers don't get significant until you get out to, you know, about greater than 9 in this study. Something else to potentially clue us into what optimal levels might be is to look at the fasting insulin found in this paper right here. Low serum insulin in traditional Pacific Islanders, the Catawba study. Now, this paper back from 1999 was by Stefan Lindenberg and his colleagues, and they looked at serum fasting insulin levels in the Catawban population and then compared them to a population in Sweden. So if we make the assumption that the Ktavans insulin levels are probably optimal due to the fact that they're metabolically healthy, largely free of chronic diseases, especially the chronic diseases that are related to metabolic disease, then what we see are levels that range from about 2 to 6. And you can see that in their data right here. So here's the Ktava people. Here's the people from Sweden. And you can see Ktavans range from about 2 to 6 for their fasting insulin levels. And that's throughout time, throughout the ages. Typically what we see in, you know, Western industrial populations that are modern, we see fasting insulin levels, one, just quite high, or much higher in general. And then they also tend to be even higher as we age. So if we look through kind of an ancestral lens, or as an ancestral lens that we can, I would say that fasting insulin of between 2 and 6 is probably ideal. And also based off of that study looking at risk of metabolic syndrome over the course of time, that also suggested less than 6 was probably ideal. I think that we can safely say that 2 to 6 is probably the range that we're looking at. And I will also say that the lower isn't always better for insulin, fasting insulin. So that's a topic for another day, but something to consider. Okay, sorry if that was a little complicated with all those studies there. But again, if you want to dig into the specific studies, please feel free to. We'll put them in the show notes. But really, you want to look at those last two studies versus the all-cause mortality studies, because I wasn't too excited about those as far as the data goes. Now, last question here. I was under the impression that houseplants could help air quality of a room or home, but after seeing this article, I'm not sure. What's the latest science on indoor plants? Do they do anything for our health? And if so, which are best? So this is the article, which is quite good. Actually, no, I don't have the article up. This is the article from The Atlantic, and we'll link to it in the show notes here. A popular benefit of houseplants is a myth. So the original study, which was right here, and conducted by NASA, did suggest that houseplants could clean the air, but the study was conducted in plexiglass containers that were quite small. So the biggest chambers that we're talking were like 30 by 30 by 60 inches, so not nearly the size of a room. And as this article here suggests, there are quite a few issues with extrapolating the original NASA data to kind of our regular living space. So first of all, we don't live in enclosed environments like plexiglass chambers. At least I hope most of us don't. Second, we'd have to literally have a room almost packed full of plants to get any kind of air purifying effect. And I'll quote from this recent article that was published in Nature. Let's see, where was it that I wanted to? And this article was alluded to in the Atlantic article, but it's called "Potted Plants Do Not Remove Indoor Air Quality: A Review and Analysis of Reported VOC Removal Efficiencies." So, this is what I wanted to highlight: necessitating the placement of 10 to 1,000 plants per meter squared of a building's floor space for the combined VOC removing ability of potted plants is to achieve the same removal rate as that outdoor to indoor air exchange already provides in typical buildings. So really it looks like just opening up some windows and getting some natural airflow is going to be a lot more beneficial as far as air quality is concerned than loading up your house with plants. Now that doesn't mean that houseplants are worthless by any means. So there have actually been some studies, and we'll link to them in the show notes, that suggest that having houseplants around you, just around in your environment, may reduce both psychological and physiological stress. Additionally, ornamental indoor plants placed in hospital rooms have been shown to improve health outcomes in surgery patients, and real plants, so as opposed to fake plants or no plants in schools, have been shown to improve attention and promote relaxation in elementary school children. So again, just because plants may not necessarily clean the air as much as we thought they would, does not mean that you should completely get rid of them altogether. Okay, That is all I have for the questions here. I'll bring them back up. Stuart, if you have any questions, comments, I'd love to hear them as always.
Just a question, really.
Yeah.
Fasting insulin, you don't test that in a standard BloodSmart AI, right?
No, we don't. It is in the forecast, I believe. But we don't test it directly. And if I were to test it directly, I would test the C-peptide instead. What I would actually think is even more beneficial, which I think I alluded to in my comment while I was answering the question, is just to do a Kraft insulin test, which is basically you do an oral glucose tolerance test where you drink a 75 or 100 gram solution of glucose. And for, say, 3 hours afterward, every 30 minutes, you're testing your glucose, but you're also testing your insulin levels. The graph of what your glucose and insulin is doing actually gives you a really good idea about kind of your pre-diabetes, diabetes status. And one caveat there for people listening, and especially you, Stuart, if you wanted to do this, typically if you're eating a lower carbohydrate diet and you do that, you can get some funky data because your body isn't used to producing a lot of insulin. So you almost look like you're a type 1 diabetic sometimes. So most people recommend that in the couple days before to the week before the test, you kind of eat at least 100 to kind of 150, 200 grams of carbs a day just to kind of prime your system for the test. So we'll put the papers, if people are interested in the Kraft test, in the show notes, because I think they're really interesting. And I'm surprised that not more people or more practitioners don't use them in clinical practice.
Yeah. I can't remember the last time I ate 200 grams of carbs in a day.
Yeah. It would be tough, especially if you're trying to get it from whole food sources. It would be difficult to eat 200 grams from sweet potatoes. We can also say, you know, if what you're doing is working for you now and you don't have any symptoms of metabolic syndrome, then why bother?
Right. That's kind of what I'm figuring. The only thing that I have in my BloodSmart is the slightly high resting glucose, which you guys have said is sort of indicative of the way I eat.
Yes. Yeah. And that's probably more indicative of cortisol output and output from, glucose in your liver, or from your liver, versus any kind of metabolic pathology.
Okay. Yeah. The other thing that this is more of a personal comment, but you know, we've done some playing around with adding carbs when I exercise, and I definitely think there's a positive effect on my exercise, but it ends up wreaking havoc with my gut still.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So I've also played around with just trying to do things that cause excess energy when I exercise. So some excess fat someplace, or one of the things I've been doing is adding egg yolk to my hamburger. So that gives me a lot of different stuff, right? A lot of nutrients and fat.
Mm-hmm.
And I haven't really done that separate from the carbs yet to see what I think in terms of energy, but just doing that seems to help with energy just because, and it makes me think I haven't done the work with chronometer yet, but it makes me think I might be low on calories every day.
Yeah. I wouldn't be surprised. It's pretty easy to undereat, if it's inadvertent.
I'm having a really hard time getting close to 1.2 grams of protein per day, just forcing myself to eat that much.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. And then you get to the point where if you're trying to consume that much protein and it's really hard for you, then that's also crowding out your other macronutrients, which are your fats and your carbs are really going to be the energy macronutrients for most people. So that's where, you kind of have to personalize and say, okay, at least right now, do I need more of the fats at the expense of the protein, or is protein the most important?
Right. I haven't done the exact work, but my guess is I'm approaching 90 or 100 grams of protein a day.
Okay.
So that's a whole lot better than where I was before I started with you guys, where I was probably only approaching 50 grams of protein a day.
Mm-hmm.
So I assume that's not a black and white issue, that it's more of a sliding scale. And so 90 grams is better than 50. Don't be upset that you're not getting 1.1 versus my body weight would be 160 grams of protein a day or something, or 170. Yeah. So yeah. Okay, cool. Yeah. And
have you, and just out of curiosity, on, you say carbohydrates are kind of wreaking havoc on your gut. Do you think that's more a carbohydrate issue or more of a fiber issue? Or do you know?
That's a good question. I guess I would say I think it's not a fiber issue because, okay. Well, there are, I don't know. That's a good question.
Like, have you tried, like white rice, for example, which is basically zero fiber, pure carbohydrate. I would wonder how that would work.
Okay,
in your gut.
I'll try it. I haven't tried it, but yeah.
I do a quarter cup of cooked white rice and see how you feel on that.
Because I definitely take a fiber supplement that I feel like, you know, it's acacia fiber, which is all soluble. And then also I take a little bit of, what's the one that's in Metamucil? I'm forgetting. It's not the same. I don't take Metamucil. I take a natural version of it, but
I'm not sure what's in Metamucil.
Organic. But anyways, I mix two things in a glass of water every night and drink it. And it seems like, you know, right now I have it in my mind that if I don't do it, it things are worse than if I do it. But those are specific fibers and they're isolated. They're not in the food and they're all these different pieces. But my experience over time with white rice is not that, like the few times where I go to a restaurant and eat white rice, because I don't eat whole grain rice anymore. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that's a good thing to not eat or not, but for whatever, at some
point. Debatable.
In my paleo education, it said, you know, white rice was probably better than whole grain rice. So I stopped eating whole grain rice.
Yeah. Probably for people with gut issues, I would say that is true. In the long term, if you're trying to optimize kind of your diversity of fibers and polyphenols that feed the gut microbes, that's where it kind of becomes more of a gray area.
Gray area. Okay. So, yeah.
Experiment. Right. See, you know, if you want to. Otherwise, I think that for some people, just getting some more energy on board, like you were saying.
Yeah, it appears that if I can do things to add some energy, that also helps. So, and I often wonder whether or not I should have a scale in the house when I'm trying to add energy, but I can't remember the last time I stepped on a scale, and I sort of base it on, well, you know, what do I look like in the mirror, and my pants still fit, so I'm not gaining inches or something on my waist. So
yeah, absolutely. And I think there's, as I've mentioned before, there's a range of calories at which you can eat and remain weight stable. And if you can eat at the top of that range versus the bottom of the range, that's going to be better for everything.
For energy. Yeah. Okay, cool. The last thing I can think of is back to really something that's very, just my own stuff for sure, which is, it looks like Genova Diagnostics finished my test. I don't know if you saw that or not.
I don't get alerted until the test results are in.
Okay.
So I will definitely, I do get alerted when they do come in. So I'll keep an eye out. And then if we need to scoot our appointment one way or the other, we can.
I don't have an appointment yet. So.
Oh, you don't? Okay. Then no. Go ahead and make one maybe for...
Whenever you have time.
Okay. Sounds good.
Next week sometime or later.
Yeah.
And then if it doesn't, I'll check in with you before we have the appointment, or you let me know if you don't have the results.
Okay. Yeah. Right. That sounds great.
Perfect. Great.
All right. Okay. Yep. Merry Christmas. Happy New Year. And if I don't talk to you before then.
Yeah. You have a Tuesday next week or not? Office hours next week?
I think so. Well, hold on a second, just for if people are still listening. let's see. Tuesday next week is the 29th. Yes, I'll be doing office hours next week. So
okay, cool. Thanks.
Merry Christmas, everyone.